I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi everyone, it's Ravi from Brighton in the UK. And you're listening to the Amazingly Fantastic 10 Years podcast.
Well, hello, folks. That was the voice of young Ravi, who a couple of years ago, aged just 6, was diagnosed with a brain tumour, a benign tumour in his brain stem. And despite 10 hours of surgery, doctors weren't able to remove the whole thing, and Ravi lives with its effects every single day. After learning to walk and feed himself again and determined to return to his passions of music and maths and sport, Ravi lives his life to the max with bravery, fun and inspirational strength. His dream is to have a future where tumours like his could be treated without the type of surgery that he went through. And he's been raising money to fund that dream ever since, including production of a wonderful music video version of A Million Dreams with stars such as Paloma Faith, Jimmy Somerville and the man himself, Hugh Jackman, taking part. And I think it's fair to say, Catherine and Matt, Catherine joining me from Turin on the final night of the ATP Finals, Matt safely arrived in Malaga. I think it's safe to say that when we watched that video of A Million Dreams, we all had the very same reaction. Matt and I watched it first and very quickly confided in one another that we were in tears. And Catherine, I mean, it really is incredible, isn't it?
Yes, and I was in tears, but I also felt tremendously happy. It's very, very uplifting and inspiring and all sorts of other trite words, which I know sound trite, but it just is. It's absolutely lovely and life-affirming, and we should all try and be more Ravi. What a cool kid Ravi seems, and yeah, really honoured to have him introduce the show and to know that he and his family are listeners. It's really lovely.
Yeah.
Good on him.
That's right. Well, Ravi's mum, Bethan, wrote to us to tell us that Ravi and all the family are big fans of tennis. I've seen pictures of Ravi playing balloon tennis with his sister in the front room, and that they're all fans of the tennis podcast. So we really are honoured to have him introducing our show. We wanted to tell you about his story and the fact that he's raised nearly £90,000 so far. And he has a fashion show that he's running next week. I mean, how cool is this kid? He's got his own fashion show.
Like a mogul.
It's unreal. Yeah. And listen, we're going to link to Ravi's website and his music video in our show notes and in the newsletter that'll be going out in a couple of days' time. And just in case you want to look at his website right now, it is ravisdream.com. So hello to Ravi and all the family. Thank you so much for introducing our show. And I think it's been a nice show to be doing, really, because it has been a fantastic week of tennis overall at the ATP Finals. You know, we'll talk about the results that we've had the last 3 days, Catherine, since we last spoke on Friday. But it did occur to me as we were sort of wrapping up the tournament, what a brilliant tour-ending finals this has been this year. You know, I often come out of the tour finals feeling like there haven't been many good matches and all this sort of thing. But whilst they were relatively straightforward the last couple of days, it's been an absolute stonker of a tournament.
It has. Yeah, I do think it did tail off just a little bit at the end, relative to expectations. You know, we had that unbelievable semi-finals lineup, which could only, no matter what scenario played out, lead to an incredible finals. And if you look at where we are now, looking back on those three matches compared to where we were when we last podded, we'd probably have said we were hoping for more. But yes, I think on aggregate, I agree with you. It has been really great. And I think the frankly, that's mostly down to the quality of tennis. Yes, the crowd are great. They really are great here in a way that I've not experienced anywhere else. They're like a football crowd. It is, you know, the chanting and the olés and everything is very special here. And it's just the right size of stadium to incubate that crowd noise and atmosphere and all the rest of it. So yes, there is all of that, but I think fundamentally the quality of the tennis is really high, and obviously that's largely down to the fact that you got the eight best players in the world. But you had the eight best players in the world in Cancun, and with the best will in the world, if the conditions aren't right, then those eight best players aren't going to be able to show you what they're capable of, which is what this event's about, really. It's saying, this is the best of the best of this sport. Look at this showcase. And I think this court, the speed of it, enables those players to do that, which is smart of the ATP, quite frankly. You could argue that some of the matches are a little too serve dominated. The doubles, definitely. This was not a doubles tournament for Matt, I don't think, who already struggles a little bit with men's doubles because of how serve dominated it was. The doubles was incredibly serve dominated. And the odd match in the singles was as well, but I think by and large, it led to some just sumptuous baseline tennis with a good amount of variety sprinkled in, which is, it's a heady concoction.
It is. Matt, when you look at the last couple of days, the results that we've had, I mean, first of all, we had Sinner getting past Medvedev, which I think in itself was a really impressive win, actually, given the record between the two of them overall, the fact that Sinner lost the second set and still then found another gear in the third. But if we just talk, first of all, about the two matches that we've just seen, both won by Novak Djokovic, frankly, routinely beating the two most exciting young players in the world in Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner. He's beaten Alcaraz 6-3, 6-2. He's beaten Sinner 6-3, 6-3 in front of Sinner's own fans. Do you come out of that marvelling at Djokovic mostly, or do you look at Alcaraz and Sinner and think, oh, well, that wasn't very good?
Good question, because that very much is what is kind of at the forefront of my mind as I watch these matches, and as I watch 36-year-old Novak Djokovic be able to just dominate the rest of the ATP tour as he has done this year. And mostly I absolutely fall on the side of Novak Djokovic is remarkable, and I think particularly in these two matches he was remarkable. I think Tománi Carroll, writing in The Guardian, put it well, where he described a little flurry that Alcaraz had in the second set, you know, where he started Alcarazing, didn't he? He did some incredible things, 2 points in a row. And then Tománi wrote that Djokovic just lifted his level into the stratosphere. And I thought that was pretty apt, really, because it was one of those moments where Alcaraz has got the crowd up. And I thought, OK, this is it. This is where the match turns. And then I think he lost 6 points in a row as Djokovic just sort of slammed the door in his face. And we've seen him do that so many times. And I think what amazes me about Djokovic is that, like, there must have been a decline generally in certain aspects of his game. You know, like, I don't think he's quite as explosive as he maybe used to be, you know, movement wise. And he doesn't quite sort of scramble as maybe as well as he used to, but he's completely made up for it by developing other aspects of his game, and that's created an overall package which doesn't feel like it's diminished at all. You know, and I'm talking a lot there about his serve. I mean, he didn't lose serve in either of these matches against Alcaraz and Sinner, two of the best returners. You know, I know the court's fast, but Djokovic is so good with his serve these days, and his forehand is cutting through the court in a way that it didn't used to. I think there was a stat that he was hitting his forehand between 10 and 20 kilometers per hour faster than Jannik Sinner in the match today, and yet he wasn't making more errors. You know, his forehand was bigger, but it was also the more solid one. It was absolutely remarkable. And then when you combine those developments in his game with the fact that he's able to assert all of his aura, and he's able to assert sort of his dominance, and, you know, he's felt all of these pressures of these matches before in a way that, you know, Jannik Sinner hasn't, for example. It just creates this package of a player which right now, in the absence of, you know, fellow greats in Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer, he's sort of got men's tennis to himself, it feels like, at the moment. So, you know, chapeau to Novak Djokovic, hats off. He has been astonishing all year, and he still is. But looking at these two matches, I did expect a bit more from Alcaraz and Sinner. I thought they were a bit wayward and error-strewn. And by the time they sort of started to find their feet in the match, Djokovic had kind of taken over and sort of crushed their soul and spirit a little bit as well. So, yes, I expected more, but Novak Djokovic is blooming good at tennis.
He is quite good, isn't he? I think Catherine makes a very interesting point, trying to compare and contrast Novak Djokovic of before and now. And I mean, I come down on the side that overall he's a better player now. He might not be able to sort of play as often and do so many spectacular things with his body maybe as he used to do, but overall with the serve, with the volley, with the sort of the court craft and the whole package of mental strength and the way he's able to, almost halfway through the tournament, he said it in the interview afterwards, didn't he, Catherine, on your coverage, how he went through these stages within the tournament of winning the match against Rune to seize the number one, which was a big deal to him, and then kind of have a bit of a dip, have a bit of flatness about him, which I don't think is surprising. He's often had that second round robin group match not go so well. And I mean, when he played Sinner in the second match, I mean, Sinner was amazing, but Djokovic was just trying to have a toe-to-toe. It was almost like he was experimenting and just seeing what he could do with the tennis ball. This wasn't that, was it? This last 2 days wasn't that. This was Novak Djokovic winning. I am going to go out and win. And there's a mode that he has that I don't think anybody else has, that mode, just a winner's mode. Alcaraz might win, Sinner might win, but they do it with shot-making. Djokovic is almost like he's got a formula. He's got an absolute cast-iron, sure-thing formula for winning tennis matches that he really needs to win.
Yes, he's defined by ruthless efficiency in every possible way, isn't he? I know a lot of people will tell you the mark of a champion is not ever being able to turn off the tap, you know, to be in the same mode, play every point the same, Nadal-like, no matter what the score, no matter whether it's a round-robin match or a knockout match or a final or a 250 or a Grand Slam, you know. In the words of Stefanos Tsitsipas at this tournament a couple of years ago, you know, being prepared to die out there. But that's not the case for Novak Djokovic. The mark of his brilliance during this era is deploying what's needed when. He didn't need to win those group stage matches. Now, I know he cut it a bit fine. He was relying on Jannik Sinner's victory over Holger Rune to get him through. But ultimately, he's got this down, hasn't he? He knows what's required of him to qualify from the group and to peak when required. And I know words like efficiency aren't sexy and he probably deserves something better, but it is at the root of his his brilliance. Just looking back now, we ran a graphic in the build-up to the match on our Prime coverage about the number of times that a player has taken on a world number one twice in the same week at this event. And it's happened quite a lot. And no player has ever beaten that world number one twice. It's never happened. And looking at that graphic, I just thought, there is no way Novak Djokovic is going to be the first man that happens to. It's just no. I don't care what this tennis match looks like. I don't care whether he comes out, you know, having to underarm serve because his shoulder's dropped off or something, and Jannik Sinner looks like the best tennis player of all time. It doesn't add up. Novak Djokovic is just not going to let himself be that guy. And it does just feel like, when he needs to turn it on, I know there are exceptions, the Wimbledon final this year most notably, but basically he produces what he needs to when he needs to do it. That is the bottom line with Novak Djokovic. He seems to have this ability to go, oh, I really want to win today, so I will. Like, he came out today and went, I could really do his serving really well today. So he makes 14 out of 16 first serves in the first set or something like that. Like, as if it's as easy as just deciding. But with Novak Djokovic, it is, seemingly.
Mm. When he really needs to, yeah. No, that's it, isn't it, Matt?
Yeah, and not to stray from Djokovic, I'm sure we can get back to him, but that point you're making there, Catherine, about, you know, the fact that no one had beaten the world number one twice in the same tournament, and the fact that Djokovic has got this quality of, you know, doing what he needs to do in any given circumstance. I think that does sort of bring us on to, you know, should Jannik Sinner have actually, you know, tanked that match against Holger Rune and taken Novak Djokovic out of the tournament. And look, I totally understand why he didn't. He was playing in Italy. He wanted to beat Holger Rune for the first time. Look, of course I get that, and I'm not surprised that he didn't. But it did sort of make me think that a lot of people have been saying that, you know, that's the real champion move for Jannik Sinner, to do that, you know, to put your heart and soul into that match. And look, maybe that is true, but equally, perhaps the baller move and the more sensible move would have been to say, you know what, I've beaten Novak Djokovic once at this tournament, I've proven it already, and off you go, Novak, and I'm now going to sort of clean up and sweep this tournament. Look, and I get why he didn't, but I think you're right that sort of champions can be built in different ways, and it's not necessarily the case that, you know, it was the wrong thing to do for Jannik Sinner to tank that match, you know, because maybe he would have ended up lifting the title had he, and titles are ultimately...
Do you think there's somebody out there in the top 10 that would have just let that match go?
I certainly think there's players that wouldn't have put in the effort, wouldn't have gone to the dark places that Jannik Sinner went to a lot. I'm not sure there's any that would have fully tanked.
Yeah,
yeah.
But the line between a full tank and a semi-tank is a blurry one, isn't it? I think there are a lot of players, particularly when it went to a deciding set, they might not have walked on the court thinking, I'm not bothered about this. They'd have probably thought, see how it goes, see how physical a match this ends up being, how much energy I have to deploy. But I think an awful lot of top players, I mean, Medvedev, I'm looking at you, and definitely Novak Djokovic, and probably Holger Rune, and I don't know, lots would have, when it went into that third set and you're feeling your lower back, thought, well, actually, conveniently, one extremely likely looking outcome of this situation is that the greatest threat to me winning this title goes out. How blooming fantastic is that? Yeah, absolutely, I do. I mean, was Daniil Medvedev putting in full effort against Carlos Alcaraz certainly in that second set, I don't know. I mean, where does loss of edge end and tanking begin? I don't think he was tanking. I don't think he had an edge either.
Mm. Yeah, it's very interesting. I'm glad that he did what he did against Rune, really, overall, but I would have still found it quite funny if he'd have revealed a dark side to himself that we didn't know he had.
Yeah, and I think maybe at this sort of still fairly early stage in Sinner's career, you know, it is best for him to still have that mentality of, you know, all out all the time. You know, that's sort of how he's got to where he is already. I'm not questioning his decision. I guess I'm questioning the analysis that the only way to be a true champion, you know, is to sort of go full out, win that match. Because you're right, there's a difference between that and just slightly not having the edge for the big picture, I suppose.
It's the way Novak Djokovic manages five set matches, isn't it? Which is what he is better at than anybody else in history. There are periods in five set matches where he's not as dialed in as the rest of the time. He's riding out a lull because he knows he'll dial it back in later when it matters most, when his energy is more needed and more efficiently deployed.
I think overall we would look at Sinner's week and think net positive, quite significant net positive. Would you agree with that?
Massive.
Oh, yeah, hell yeah.
What about Carlos Alcaraz? Because I was just thinking, you know, back to, he had some good wins at the US Open and then he had a disappointing loss to Medvedev. From his perspective, he hasn't really been himself since he lost that Cincinnati final. Like, he hasn't completely wowed us and convinced us, I don't think, at least, in the same way. I thought he was going to win that Cincinnati final. I was watching it back, actually, on the Prime coverage when they had build-up time and fill time, and it was really interesting to watch that. And it felt, because of the Wimbledon win, he had the mental edge at that point, and I felt like Djokovic was having to wrestle with his own self-belief just a little bit there and convince himself and prove to himself that he got this guy, that he could take this guy out. And Cincinnati proved to him that he could, even when it was tight, even when Alcaraz was playing well. I just see little flickers of self-doubt in Alcaraz at the moment. And I wonder about whether he's slightly in awe of Djokovic and the fact that he's playing practice sets with him and losing them. Like, I mean, I think he lost 1-6-1 the other day is what I heard. And I don't know whether that's the smartest thing to do, really, to play practice sets with Novak Djokovic and to practice with him generally. I think he's got to build himself up a little bit again, I feel, in his mind. And I just wonder whether you feel that he has been damaged a little bit psychologically by what's happened the last few months. Catherine, what do you think?
Yes, I do. I do think that Cincinnati final set him back a bit temporarily. I actually don't think this week is a negative for Carlos Alcaraz. He actually quite significantly exceeded my expectations for him this week. I think his trip to Turin is a neutral, if not a minor positive, the fact that he was able to improve so much with each match. And okay, he ran into Novak Djokovic yesterday and fell pretty short. But I still think it, when he was good, particularly in that second set, it was the most comfortable he's looked on that court. Rafael Nadal never got there with these surfaces, with a fast indoor court. I think Alcaraz will get there more so than Nadal ever has, but it's going to take a long time. So actually, I think this week in Turin has been kind of fine for Novak Djokovic, for Carlos Alcaraz rather. But I definitely do agree with the larger analysis that was a setback mentally, and perhaps the first big one that he's had in his career. It was just all upward trajectory, wasn't it, for Alcaraz? And I see the same. I see those flickers of self-doubt, and the practice sets thing. I wonder whether he'll do it again. I do. I don't blame him for doing it, but having lost 1-6-1, yeah, I do. I maybe we'll keep a close track on that, whether that sort of makes him think twice about it. I mean, look at Jannik Sinner today. First set is all about Djokovic being utterly unplayable. His first serve in those conditions, the way he was delivering it and backing it up, of course, from the back of the court, but it was unplayable. Chapeau, Novak Djokovic. Second set was quite a different story. There were moments midway through the second set, Sinner's a breakdown. He's at the nothing to lose stage of proceedings. Djokovic got so tight and Sinner had him on the ropes, and he played the reputation in those moments. Sinner let him off the hook. And it's understandable. This is what Novak Djokovic does to people. He makes you think that you've got to go for that little bit extra on your forehand. He makes an extra thought cross through your mind before you decide to hit a shot that leads to indecision and a framer or a miss hit or whatever it might be. He makes you doubt yourself in the way that you never would against somebody else. But it is a little bit troubling to see that happening to the generation that are supposed to not have the scar tissue against Novak Djokovic yet. We've kind of written off Tsitsipas and in progressively over the last 10 years. We've written off Dimitrov. We've written off Thiem. We've written off Tsitsipas and Zverev. They've all got too much scar tissue. But don't worry, along come these 20-year-olds and 21-year-olds that are fresh and have all the chutzpah. They haven't built it up yet. And yet here they are building it up. Now, I still think it's reversible, but it's pretty extraordinary and a tiny bit alarming to see that happening in one so young.
Yeah, I think that's all really, really interesting. What I would say is that, like, I don't think Alcaraz would swap his head-to-head with Djokovic this year. Like, I think he would still want to have won that Wimbledon one over the others. Like, I know he may well have gone on to win the French Open. If you give him that semi-final, he probably would have beaten Casper Ruud in the final. But, you know, he did sort of win the big one. So I think sort of overall, it's been, you know, it's been a great year, obviously, for Alcaraz. And I don't think we're quite there yet with Alcaraz in terms of baggage. But I do agree that something does seem to have shifted a little bit since that Cincinnati final. Like, I mean, he must have thought he had scaled the mountain beating Djokovic in the Wimbledon final over five sets. You know, I mean, extraordinary. And then the next time he plays him, you know, this guy is just back at him again, going, what was it, almost about 4-hour match, wasn't it? In brutal conditions, and Djokovic saved a match point. And then, you know, there must have just been this feeling of, gosh, right, okay, you're coming at me again, are you? And I think he was a bit shocked yesterday, Alcaraz. Like he said, I was not at that level. And I think he was shocked by how good and how sort of conditioned Djokovic was just in that moment in a way that he wasn't. And I just back Alcaraz to learn from that and get better from that in a way that I think some other players have just accumulated so much baggage. I still think Alcaraz is different. But yeah, you're right. It has become really, really interesting, that rivalry. If, you know, it was already, but even more so now.
Yeah, there are different elements at play. I mean, I'm fascinated to see what a Carlos Alcaraz uninjured off season looks like and what he comes out like in 2024 physically. And I mean, I think I'm really interested to see him at the Australian Open. The conditions wise, the court, the heat, it seems to me that it should suit him down to the ground, but you know, we'll wait and see. There's a lot of reasons why I'm not a huge fan of him playing against Novak Djokovic in Saudi Arabia. But I also think, again, you're playing him in an exhibition. I'm not sure that's the best idea. I think you've got to have a bit of distance from him. I think that Djokovic is finding out more about you than you're finding out about him.
Yeah.
Really. He's the wily veteran with all these years of experience under his belt, just accumulating data. I think you're having a great time and experiencing the tour and experiencing these situations, but I'm not as convinced that it's the best idea.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. Roger Federer used to invite the youngsters, didn't he, to come and hit with him in the off season, and they all went, "Boah, brilliant. Oh my God, I'm getting to hit with Roger Federer, and lovely." And Roger Federer gets to look like he's sort of doing community service for the youth, but actually he's being utterly ruthless and data gathering. Two birds, one stone. Brilliant.
Oh, it's still a mouthwatering prospect though, isn't it? The thought of Australia 2024. Hopefully they're just all fit and they can all have an off-season. Boris Becker and Holger Rune have revealed that they're going to be extending their partnership into the new year and for the whole of 2024. That's going to be really interesting.
And personally, I think next year is just fascinating for Novak Djokovic generally, because, you know, we know how much he has targeted majors over the last few years, and he has rocketed into the lead in the Grand Slam race. And I've no doubt that those are still going to be the priority. But it's interesting to hear him talk about, you know, kind of wanting to break every record that he possibly can. And, you know, there's two main ones that I look at, and those are the number of ATP titles generally. He's moved on to 98 now. Jimmy Connors is on 109, I believe. So, you know, still a way to go, but it's within sight. And then, of course, the Olympic gold, which I just think is huge for Djokovic next year. And I was thinking about Djokovic's career today, and I noticed this slight pattern that what I would call his best ever seasons have always been just before an Olympic year, and he hasn't been able to then turn it into an Olympic gold medal. You know, think 2011, extraordinary season, gets to number one, the winning streak. 2012 Olympics, he lost to Murray, didn't he? And then 2015 was that year where he was absolutely sublime. And then 2016 Olympics, he loses to Juan Martín Del Potro and leaves the court in tears. I think the 2020-21 sort of Olympic cycle is all sort of ruined really because of COVID. But now we're in a situation again where he's had an extraordinary season going into an Olympic year. And I just think that's going to be such a huge priority for him. And it might make him a little bit more vulnerable at the slams. He's going to have to think about his scheduling, I think.
I think it might make him more vulnerable at the Summer Slams for sure. Because looking back on the 2020 Olympics that were staged in 2021, ironically, given how enormous a goal Olympic gold is for him, because of the incredible season that he ended up having, the Olympics sort of became an inconvenience for him, because he was on for the calendar slam. And what he really could have done with was focusing on the US Open. But then it became about the Golden Slam. Oh my God, you could do what only Steffi Graf has done before you. But then by not winning Olympic gold, that momentum got interrupted. And there was the whole hoo-ha with the mixed doubles, wasn't there? They ended up pulling out of. It was a very strange tension between that being one of his ultimate goals, but actually it coming at a totally inconvenient moment in his career. Well, it is entirely plausible that that could happen next year, and he would need to make the most difficult of choices about what to prioritise, because he will be 37 at the time of the Olympics. I know he's defying what being 37 means, but he's defying it by making smart choices about his schedule. And those choices aren't going to get any easier.
Yeah, it will be. It will be very interesting to see how he manages that situation. And also just what goes before too, because your season, I suppose, looks different if you've won the first two Grand Slams of the year or not. That decision-making element might impact things, I suppose.
And everybody is always keen to point out, players are always keen to point out that one of the things that's hardest on the body is change of surface. Well, he's going to go clay, grass, clay. I mean, everybody is within a very short space of time. And I know the natural surfaces are kinder on the body than hard court, but again, 37 years old, it's going to be a tough summer.
Mm. Yep.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Absolutely. Well, in the doubles, we had another defence of a title and another incredible run by Joe Salisbury and Rajiv Ram, who've now won their last 10 matches. I was hearing you saying, Catherine, in the prime coverage, that they've won 10 matches in a row in Turin, two undefeated titles, to end the season winning the ATP Finals, beating Horacio Zabias and Marcel Granollers 6-3, 6-4. They also won the US Open. They'd won three in a row of those. And it's just hard to fathom, to credit, that these two were really struggling for the first 6 months of the year. I mean, I think they were even questioning their partnership, which is, what, 5 years old now. It wasn't happening for them, and suddenly now they are the team.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they pretty much said they were questioning their partnership, and I wonder if that'll send a message to other teams about, you know, the value of sticking with it through rough times. I mean, that's not going to be the right course of action for everyone, but it does seem to be there's quite a lot of knee-jerk hitting the panic button if things aren't going right, and I'm so glad it's paid off for them. And they're expert at defending titles, aren't they? They're the anti-Daniil Medvedev. Three back-to-back US Open titles and now two back-to-back titles here. They're obviously a team that just come to places and suddenly feel completely at home and unbeatable. And it was, I mean, I'm assuming, Matt, because you're in Malaga and Davis Cup focused, I'm assuming you weren't able to watch that doubles final. Yeah, don't watch it back, Matt. It's about as serve dominated a performance as you can get from Ram and Salisbury, which is what works in these conditions. We are at altitude here in Turin. I know only 300 metres, but it definitely makes a difference. And frankly, they were unplayable today with both their serves firing the way they were. It was a masterclass.
I hope I'm okay to share this, because I had a message earlier from Matt Futterman, now of The Athletic, and I think he'd been watching that doubles, and he messaged to say, how would I feel about only one serve in doubles? He said, I think it could save it. Faster, more rallies, brakes and lead changes. And I haven't formulated my full thoughts on that yet, but I do think that it would only apply to men's doubles for sure, because I don't think it's such an issue in women's doubles or mixed doubles, because yeah, it just isn't as serve dominated. But yeah, I do find men's doubles quite a tough watch sometimes, just because it's so serve dominated. If you can't get that return back, you know, if you're not Novak Djokovic being able to read serves and put them back on opponents' toes, which I feel like I spent my entire weekend watching him do that. If you can't do that, and not many can, I don't think it makes for a brilliant spectacle generally. You do get some amazing sharp rallies at the net, and the reflexes are kind of astonishing, and the hand skills and all of that, but It's a lot of serving and walking to the other side in between.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. One serve, I think I might quite like that.
I'd love to see it trialed for sure.
Stick it in the next gen. I don't have any doubles. Catherine, I think we've got to lose you now, haven't we? It's time for you to go and join your colleagues on the Prime Video team, because tonight is the farewell party from Amazon Prime Video in the UK.
It's
been 5 years.
Yes.
I have to say, you were incredible today. Your presenting of that coverage was amazing, and couldn't believe how good it was. Well, I could believe. But anyway, it was amazing. How do you feel? How do you feel now that you've done your final event for Prime Video?
All right, really. It's been great. But it feels very fitting that the first thing I do after coming off air is come back and record a podcast with my favourite people.
Oh.
So, yeah, I feel all right. And I always feel all right about leaving the pod a bit early, because it means that I get a bit of the pod to listen to.
Yeah.
Tomorrow when I'm in a car at 7 a.m.
Yeah, because I'm going to ask Matt stuff now. So bye-bye, Catherine. We'll do shout-outs in the next episode.
Make it good, guys.
Yeah, we're not even going to do an episode mascot, because there's no chance that we can have pets being discussed not in Catherine's company. So Catherine, have a lovely night. Travel safely back home, and we'll speak to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
I'm going to miss Catherine presenting the tennis terribly. It's been amazing. And I'm also going to miss being able to count my Amazon Prime subscription as a work expense.
Very good point. Matt Roberts. Oh, right, Malaga, how's today been?
Do you know, two of my favourite things happened today. The first was, I got praised for my Spanish by the taxi driver, which is always a great moment, because I'm always worried that I'm losing it every year. But that was a good moment. And I got mistaken for a tennis player.
Oh, come on then. Who mistook you for a tennis player, and which tennis player?
Well, the same taxi driver. There was a serious mix-up, because my flight was about an hour delayed and I got in at the same time as the Serbian team, and while sort of we were all arriving at the airport at the same time, I think they were just expecting to be picking up the Serbian team. So I said, I'm here for transport, and he went, oh yes, let's go. And he sort of started talking to me, and it became apparent that he thought I was, yeah, I think he thought I was Laszlo Gera. I'm gonna give the credit to my Wilson jumper that I was wearing. Shout out Wilson. Okay. I maybe just looked a bit more like a tennis player than I might normally, but we did get halfway to the car, and I think he realised I didn't have any tennis rackets whatsoever, and that he'd made a terrible mistake, and actually Laszlo Gera was meant to be getting him in my car and not me. So I was handed over to someone else.
Similar backhands. he knew. Okay. Well, What's happening next, Matt? Because the Davis Cup final starts on Tuesday. Novak Djokovic is going to be on his way. What happens tomorrow, on Monday?
Yeah, so lots of press conferences tomorrow. We had just one today, which was the defending champions, Canada. We're in their press conference today. you know, tennis comes at you fast. One minute you're talking about Jannik Sinner and the future, and the next minute you're in a Milos Raonic press conference, and it's just a lot to get your head around, I suppose. But Auger-Aliassime was there, and you know he's obviously going to be a big player for Canada. He was talking about the fact that he went out onto the centre court and sort of tried to take in some of the memories from last year, because you know it's the same arena, and he sort of led Canada to that title last year. And yeah, I think he's just very pleased to be back. He's certainly got a lot better memories of this event than I have, because unfortunately tennis podcast listeners will remember that I only managed, I think, 2 podcasts last year before getting struck down by flu. So a lot of people here have been saying to me, hope you managed to last longer than 2 days this year, Matt. And I'm like, yeah, that is the plan. But yes, so hopefully I will make it through the event, and we've got lots of press conferences tomorrow, and then sort of all the action gets underway on Tuesday, as you said.
Oh, I'm pumped. Well, I hope you, most of all, I hope you're fighting fit all week long to properly enjoy it this time, because, I mean, you know, it was distressing to see you so ill last time. And I'm just not going to allow it this time, Matt, so you need to be in good shape. We have our own mascots, although we're not going to reveal our week's mascot until tomorrow, when Catherine can fawn all over the picture that I've got in front of me right now. I've got Maisie, and Maisie, I disgraced us with my Andrei Rublev pick, which I kind of did as a joke, because I just thought, well, I'm so far ahead anyway, I don't need to worry about it. I'll just go for my old mate Andrei. Catherine has got Xenia, Matt's got Darwin. None of us won, did we? None of us went for Novak Djokovic. What on earth were we thinking?
Well, when you're last, like I am, you need points. And although Novak Djokovic guarantees you points, I suppose, maybe that would have been the smart play. He doesn't get you very many. So
no.
Story of my year, really. Near miss, Jannik Sinner.
Oh, dear. Yeah. That was a good shout. He did you proud. Billie Jean the Dog is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. Our top folks and executive producers are Jamie, Hannah and Drew. We don't have shout-outs today because we're going to save them for tomorrow. But just a little bit of a reminder to go and check out Ravi's website. Our wonderful intro for today, ravisdream.com. It'll really make you feel special to see his journey and to realize what he's done under such difficult circumstances. And we're thinking of you, Ravi, and we're right behind you. Keep going.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.